is Elizabeth Ritter interviewing Ann Schaefer on June 24, 2004 in Memphis, Tennessee.
I have a little lapses, so you have to
sure.
have to watch me.
Sure. Okay. And let's make the testing. 1, 2, 3. Okay. It's working. And I'm just going to be jotting down some words that you say that later on we'll have to go over the spelling of them, so I make sure I'm accurate. But yeah, I was interested in learning about, I saw you were head of the League of Women Voters in the late 50s and 58 to 61, and interested in your political activity and civil rights activity, particularly in the late 50s and early 60s.
Well, I joined the League of Women Voters at the suggestion of a mayor of Memphis, Edmund Argall.
Okay.
I had worked in his campaign for mayor, and when his campaign was over, he said, I recommend the League of Women Voters to all you ladies.
Huh.
So,
was this in his campaign in 1955 when he first ran for mayor?
I don't remember now which one.
Okay. But,
well, it was the one that was just concluded in 55, I guess,
okay.
If that's the right year.
Yeah.
Because I went into the league in 58, I think.
Okay.
And I really didn't know what the league was all about. But
or his gubernatorial campaign?
What?
Because I know he ran for governor in 1958.
Well, this was right after his... I thought it was for his campaign for mayor, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
If I look at all this stuff, if I have enough of it written down, then I know I'm clearer on it, you know. But just drawing it out of the air, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was, I admired him very much. He was a good mayor, and he lost his election because the white citizens council and all those kind of segregationist groups, they attacked him unmercifully. And he was, they showed a picture, they went around passing out this picture to all the lines of voters on election day, picture of him with some black people and shaking a hand with a black man. And they said, see, a vote for Argall is an invitation to a nigger for dinner. It was awful. It was so bitter, and so he didn't get reelected or elected to, if that was the governor's campaign, but I don't remember. So, you know, he was just a really good man, and he was trying to be fair and honest, and I supported him wholeheartedly. So, whatever I did, I was interested in the racial equality issue. Then the League of Women Voters had two or three black members, and the league they had two or three different chapters and had lost their charter. Not lost their charter, what did they do? They just collapsed after a while. Because the local politics didn't trust them. The old line politicians, if you weren't either a Democrat or a Republican, you know, they didn't know, they thought you were communist.
Huh.
So they called the league communist, and especially because we had a black member or two. So we just lived with that. And the only place we could meet in Memphis in 1958 and all through that period was at the YMCA, YWCA, and they had a really nice big office and recreation and social building, you know, downtown. It would accommodate all kind of things.
Yeah.
So we met there, and we met at Lemoyne Owen College, the black college. So, you know, we those are the only places we could meet. Oh, the Unitarian Church. We sometimes met there. Nobody else let a mixed group meet in their building or school or church or whatever. So it was just too controversial, and, you know, and people just wouldn't stick their necks out. So we worked on the issue. Oh, and the Freedom Train, I don't know if you remember what that's about. The documents, what documents, the federal document, papers.
Yeah.
It came through Memphis, and the League, the League supported its coming, but the city objected to its coming because it was had to be integrated. And they would not allow white and blacks to go in on the Freedom Train at the same time. So anyway, we supported that. And then I had a couple of friends, one lady on the League board, the treasurer, Alma Hansen, I mentioned her in that little book. She was a white lady from, I don't remember now, up in New England, either New Hampshire or somewhere up there. She was a Congregationalist missionary. And Lemoyne Owen College was originally a Congregationalist school. It probably still is. Miss Hansen, we all called her Miss Hansen, said we got really close to her and called her Alma, but she had been the treasurer of that college. And so she was the one then who got us in all the time for our meetings. She'd set up the meetings over there. And I learned to respect her and like her very much. And I was in and out of Lemoyne Owen College a lot. So, and then we had on the, also over there at Lemoyne Owen College, a black lady who was a linguist. She taught, I don't know now, English and whatever. She had made a study. She has quite a reputation for her achievements. She did a study of dialects, and she's well known for that. Her name is Dr. Juanita Williamson. She died now some years ago, too. But so I developed a number of black friends. Then I was raised Catholic here in Memphis, and of course Catholics were in a minority too. And my mother raised me to, you know, keep your religion and your politics to yourself, because you'd be, you know, you might run into trouble somewhere if you make an issue of anything. Well, but so the Catholic Church was small here in the South, and in Memphis too, and they would not take a stand on the racial issue. We had an elderly bishop. He lived in Nashville, and a synagogue was bombed in Nashville, and so he wouldn't take any stand at all on the civil rights movement when it started. So I got into a hassle with them, and it was a number of other people. We formed a group called Catholic Human Relations Council. It was a member of the International, or the National Catholic, what's it called? Something for interracial justice. I've forgotten the name of And then the local clergy called us all a bunch of communists, and so we. There was a lot of harassment, you know, that we did run into, and I'd get letters in the mail, mostly anonymous, you know, and telephone calls that were awful. That if you got a chance to go by that Women's Foundation.
Not yet.
It's down on South, I didn't know where it was exactly, but it's on 3rd Street at the corner of Madison and 3rd, I believe. That's their office. And but they wrote up a little history of this group called Concerned Women.
Okay.
And that's where we took a lot of harassment too, because it was a citywide group. That is, we had Jewish members and Catholics and Protestants and I don't know what else. And so we took a stand with the black men who were setting up the civil rights movement at the time. And they planned, the whites were saying there's no poor people in Memphis. That's what they were saying. We were defending the poor, which we thought were mostly black. And so all these whites were saying, there are no poor people in Memphis. So this black group set up an itinerary for us to go on a bus and tour some black poor people.
This was in the late 60s?
lose my train of thought and I had to work at getting it back. Anyway, I came home one day from one of those meetings and there was this huge pile of sand in the front yard. 3 tons of sand. And the phone rang off the wall for about 3 or 4 days and I finally just left it off the hook. I'd pick up the phone, I'd say hello, and they'd say, should have been nigger shit, and they'd hang up and call right back. I'd think it was somebody else, surely, and I'd pick it up and say hello, and they'd say, should have been nigger shit. You know, that just went on for 2 or 3 days. I never could understand how people could be like that, but it just made me more determined to stay in the fight. So,
mentioned on the phone too about how there was a bishop who went around or priest talk equating civil rights workers with communism and how that made a lot of people fearful of getting involved with that.
The priest was a member of the John Birch Society and his name was Father Edward Cleary. Now family and all, they ignore this part of his life and his career, but, you know, he was an organizer. And he went on all over the South on a speaking circuit talking about anybody who got involved with the interracial movement was a communist or a dupe of the communist. And he was a fiery speaker, you know, speaker. He went all over the South. It's, you know, unless people reacted negatively to him, then he won them all over. And so I think, you know, we had a lot of that going on, and that's why it became so hard to overcome the barriers. But anyway, he picked on me one day. Well, I wrote a letter to the Pope, and I didn't tell anybody I had done it, but some of the priests found out about it, and they told it around, so he told it around. He said, she's a nut. She's even written to the Pope. And so, but I wrote to the Pope because I had been writing to that little bishop in Nashville telling him to shut this man up, that it was wrong, he was wrong, we were not communists. And we were good Catholics, this Catholic Human Relations Council, they were all good Catholic people. They were white and black Catholics in it. And so one of the men who helped get it organized was a black man, a principal of one of the city schools, high schools. So it was some prominent people in there who were black, and they were, you know, for racial justice. And I thought, you know, this man Cleary, he didn't know who anybody was. He painted us all with this broad brush. And the little bishop up there in Nashville, after the synagogue was bombed in Nashville, then he wouldn't do a thing. And this priest just, you know, had free reign. So the Pope sent a different bishop over here, a man from Birmingham, who had some experience, I don't know how much, with the civil rights activity in Birmingham. And he had read the letter of Dr. King's from the Birmingham jail. Now, whether he visited Dr. King in jail or not, I don't know. It's possible he did. I've forgotten all that. You know, I read it, some of it in a newspaper article, but I don't recall the details. So anyway, his name was Bishop Joseph A. Durick, D-U-R-I-C-K. And when he got to Memphis, he called me up and said, come to my office, I want to see you. Well, see, he got the letter that I sent to the Pope. They sent it back to the bishop, who then called me on the carpet. Well, I told him that my whole life was a spiritual journey, that I was no communism involved. And so after two or three meetings, I convinced him. And so he went out and took a stand himself. And then he got two or three of the other priests to go with him. So that kind of broke up the block of anti-communist, you know, position the church had in Memphis. So they all went down and marched on Main Street in one or two of the marches. And all the conservative Catholics were enraged that the bishop was out there with the communists, you know. Anyway, it all finally eventually blew over, but...
Yeah. When was this that Father Cleary was going around talking about civil rights workers as equated with communism? Was this in the 60s or the 50s and the 60s?
I want to say 50s and 60s. Because he was pastor of one of Memphis's largest Catholic parishes, out in Whitehaven, and he had all this John Birch literature for sale in the vestibule of the church. That book, None Dare Call It Treason. Have you ever run into that?
No.
Well, I never forget that book. But anyway, there's some other stuff. And he would get up on Sunday and allude to a lot of that stuff, you know. He believed it, every word. And then, so his church bulletins had a considerable amount in them, and I do have some copies of those bulletins, but I don't know if I could put my hand on them right now. I'll think about it a minute and see if I can remember.
Bishop Joseph Durick, that must have been around the mid-1960s.
Yeah, it was 65 when Durick got here.
Okay. And before he met with you, he hadn't taken a stand for civil rights, but then afterward.
Now, he may have done it in Birmingham. See, I don't know what he did. I don't know how it was. This was Pope Paul VI.
Yeah.
I don't know how Paul VI knew about Durick and selected him, because he was not a bishop. He might have been an auxiliary bishop in Birmingham. I don't know that either. But he definitely leaned in the same direction I leaned in, so it wasn't any leap for him to change when he got here.
Sure, sure. One of the things that I've looked at in my research is a case study for what Memphis politics and civil rights activity was like at that time, was the 1959 city election in which Russell Sugarman ran for the Public Works Commission post. And I saw that there was a big movement among most white citizens to defeat Sugarman, and that that was a really big thing in the city that he ran. And I was wondering if you remember anything about that.
Yes, I do, because I supported Russell Sugarman and I supported A.W. Willis and Jesse Turner. And they ran, as they ran for an office, if there were two or three white candidates in there, they would agree among themselves which one would get out, so the black wouldn't have as much chance to get elected. There's an awful lot of maneuvering going on that way.
Yeah.
I was kind of on the fringe, you know. I wasn't very involved in that, but I did support them. They knew that I supported them. And, you know, I was just one of those radical whites that, you know, they knew, well, she's, you know, they tried to discredit you and ridicule you, you know.
Who tried to discredit or ridicule?
The whites. To discredit me because I was supporting the black candidates. Then the group that, when Mr. Crump died, now he died in 54, I think, and then that's when Memphis politics opened up. Everybody was scrambling to be the leader, and there were so many of them fighting among themselves. And some of the people who had been Mr. Crump's leaders, you know, he had them all appointed to all the different commissions and whatnot. So they were all vying for power too. And when I ran in, when I got involved with the city in 64, I supported Pete Sisson for commissioner. Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I did that, I did not know him at all, but he was running against a man who was a Crump man, had been a Crump man, and he was running on a ticket that was called Keep Memphis Down in Dixie, I think is what the name of it was. So I just didn't vote for any of those people. You know, I voted for the independents who were not racist. Mm-hmm. And so where are we going with that?
Do you remember what people were saying about Sugarman's candidacy and the candidacy of blacks at that time?
You know, only that they were, whites did not want any blacks getting elected. They didn't say too much about them except, you know, they were niggers. I hate to keep saying that word, but that's what they said.
Yeah.
And you know, they were really fearful. I mean, genuinely fearful for themselves and their families if a black stepped out of line, crossed the segregation line. You know, it just didn't. I know how and why all, because I had grown up with it. I knew where they were coming from. But, you know, how grown people could have been so fearful.
Yeah.
A lot of them knew black people. You know, most people in the South had grown up with domestic help in the house, taking care of the babies and cooking the meals and putting them on the table and everything. They weren't afraid of those black people, but those were not the people out there marching for equal rights.
Yeah.
So it was the thrust for equal rights that terrified the whites. Mm. And I had gotten to know some prominent blacks. I met the first ones I met were two Catholic women, black women. One was Jesse Turner's wife, Allegra Turner, And another one was Mighty Singstack, who just died last week or 2 weeks ago. And so those were both religious women. Mighty Singstack had been a Catholic also. And I got with those two, and we integrated some Catholic women's groups, a retreat and a luncheon, and you know, I just said, let's go together, and we went together to these things and marched right in and sat down and ate and did that. So, you know, and they were both educated women. So, you know, and somebody said, well, yeah, you know the educated ones. You don't know these others. Well, you know, these others, quote, were, you know, they were decent human beings too. And then, of course, some of them were lawyers and doctors and bankers. Jesse Turner was a banker. So I got elected to the State Constitutional Convention in 1965. Well, the Shelby County delegation had 8 people. And all white males except Jesse and me. So we were staying in the, what's that hotel in Nashville? I forget for sure which hotel it was. Old hotel. Jefferson Davis or, I don't know, somebody, some, you know, old founding father of something or other. Anyway, so a lot of times in the morning when I'd come down for breakfast, if I saw Jesse sitting over there by himself, I'd go sit with him and eat breakfast with him. And I think that horrified some of them, because we had in our delegation of delegates, Wythe Chandler, quite young Wythe Chandler, Frierson Graves, I can't think of the other guys' names. Morgan, one of them was Morgan. Anyway, they would not have a caucus, a Shelby County caucus, which was the thing to do, so that all the delegates from Shelby County discussed the issues, you know, and we knew how we wanted to vote. Well, because of Jesse Turner and me, they wouldn't have a caucus. So they never had a meeting of the Shelby County delegation. So there were 2 other women up there. Jesse was the only black man in the convention. And these other 2 women, one from Nashville and one from Oak Ridge. And Molly Todd was the lady from Nashville. She was very progressive for her day, and Prince was the lady in from Oak Ridge, Audrey Prince. Her husband was a city judge, and me. So there were the 3 women. Well, they accepted Molly Todd because she was already in with the Republican or Democratic, whichever party it was she was in. They all already knew her and accepted her. They accepted Audrey Prince because her husband was a judge. But they didn't accept me because they didn't know where I was coming from. I was not an active party person. And I was in that League of Women Voters, which they were suspicious of, too. In fact, the way I got into that was, for a couple of years, the reapportionment of the state legislature was the main item of study in the League of Women Voters. So I had been through all that study for a couple of years, and I thought, well, I can run for that convention because I knew that issue. Mm-hmm. And that was my only qualification for doing it, you know.
And who elected you to the...
Yeah, I was elected in a citywide race.
Oh, okay.
And they didn't think nobody took me seriously. They didn't think I would win. There was a lawyer running against me. But I had been City Beautiful chairman, and so I had, you know, kind of gotten known around town. So I beat the lawyer. I've forgotten his name now, but, well, it really shocked him when I won that race. Then after that, I ran for the city council. Well, 10 men came out and ran against me, including Wythe Chandler.
1967?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because then they knew I might get elected again. So somebody told me, the big guns are going to come out against you. Just wait. Because I announced first. Then I just sat there and let them all come out and declare against me. but I really didn't care. You know, I would like to have gotten elected the 2 times I ran. But it wasn't something had a lot of. My heart wasn't totally 100% in it. You know, it wasn't going to hurt me if I didn't get elected. So when I did not get elected to the city council and saw who all did get elected, I was glad I didn't get elected. Because they fought every day down there. You know, there was a black group and a white group, and they had never mixed before. But it was same way with the school board. They had blacks on the school board and whites on the school board for the first time. And and the whites usually were the most conservative, you know. They were the ones who were out there to stop this evil trend we were on, you know. So it wasn't a good place to be, to, you know.
And you ran for city council in 1967? You said you ran again?
No, I ran just for I got elected the first time.
Oh, with the Tennessee Constitution. Mm-hmm.
And then the second time, I never tried again. Somebody said try again, but, you know, it wasn't worth it to me. It's a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And we had that during the city council race. We had the open housing issue come up. And so the black group put out a questionnaire where you stood on open housing. So I said yes, I was for open housing, and I signed the letter. Mm-hmm. Well, that killed me right there, you know, because so Wythe Chandler went around town saying, she's for open housing. If you want a nigger living on your block, just vote for her.
Because what did open housing mean?
Meant they couldn't segregate the streets. You know, anybody would have, if they had the money to buy on any street, they could buy where they wanted to buy, which you couldn't do back then.
Yeah.
And the first black family that moved out here, it's over north of Poplar, he was a man I had known in the Catholic Human Relations Council. I'll say his name in a minute. Won't come to me yet, but he was also a school principal, high school principal, and a white friend bought the house and then turned around and resold it to him. That's the only way he broke that neighborhood. Well, he was a good-natured man, the black man. He said, I need to put a sign in my yard. I want to put a sign out there that says the nigger lives here, because his front was cleaner and neater than the neighbor's. He said, I don't want them to think that's the house down there where I live. They had a lot of stuff piled in their carport.
I noticed looking at the press conference that there were a few whites.
Yeah, I voted for the black candidates in every race since they started running.
Wow.
And missed one.
What Why do you think that whites were so fearful and thought it was so dangerous?
Because I listened to them talk. You know, I lived with them.
Yeah.
Well, they were afraid of intermarriage. That was the big thing, see.
Uh-huh.
What's that word? Miscegenation?
Yeah, yeah.
I got literature in the mail, anonymous literature, little pamphlets about that one issue.
Huh.
And that it would lead to interracial marriage.
Huh.
And they didn't want interracial marriage.
Yeah.
Well, of course, it has led to interracial marriage, but I think interracial marriage among all people is the only thing that enables people to overcome the barriers that the walls they've built up around themselves, which keeps hate going.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, as a child, I grew up here in Memphis and down in Mississippi, where my mother's people all had come from, and my mother was half German and half Italian. The German and the Italian people lived in Vicksburg, where my mother came from. My daddy was 3/4 Irish and 1/4 Spanish. Mm-hmm. Well, those people didn't like each other in my mother's family. The Germans didn't like the Italians, and the Italians looked down their nose at the Germans. My grandmother and the uncles and all that stuff. It's a cultural thing. They've all, up until we started really mixing, they all grew up in a little segregated neighborhood.
Yeah.
Where in a lot of cases, they didn't all speak English. So the Italians spoke Italian and the Germans spoke German and all of that. And they never really got to know each other. They didn't work at trying. The church didn't encourage it. They had a church with a German pastor and a church with an Italian pastor so he could talk to those people who couldn't speak English. So nobody was promoting mixing these nationalities.
Yeah.
But now I grew up in a family that was mixed.
Yeah.
And when I would hear these derogatory statements made, that old Dago, or what do they call the German, Kikes, you know, I bristled a little bit every time I heard it. The dirty Irish, they called the dirty Irish all the time. And I'd ask my daddy where he came from. He said he was Cajun. He grew up in down right out of New Orleans. His parents migrated to the U.S. and came in New Orleans. Well, the Italians and the Germans, I think. No, some of them came into New York. But anyway, I don't know how they ever got together and married one another, but they did. And now you see so much of that has, you don't even think about that anymore, the prejudice between those people.
Right.
So after a generation or two of intermarriage, that's no longer an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided, after a generation or two of the white and black intermarriage, you know, it would be less and less of an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I was for it all along.
Mm-hmm.
And I think today there's still got to be a lot of intermarriage between Arabs and Christians and Jews, whatever, you know, until that just seems to be the only thing that breaks down the hatred.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I saw that I read in opinion piece in the Washington Post that talked about the 59 election, and they said among the white community underlying it was a fear of school integration, and that's why a lot of whites were opposed to the election of black
people. Yeah, they didn't want their children going to school with blacks, black children. You know, I heard an awful lot of that. I also was, my husband was called back in the military. It was during the Korean War. They sent the group headquarters to California from here to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, to California. It was a Memphis reserve outfit. Well, when I didn't have my child yet by then. I still didn't have any. But all the other mothers were thrilled to death to be going to California because they had free kindergartens. Mm-hmm. Well, when we got to California and they went down to the school to take their little children to the school, they saw the mixture. And it terrified some of those ladies. They did not want their children down there in that school with Mexicans and blacks and Indians and whatever. You know, it was a real, we were in Northern California, 60 miles north of Sacramento at Camp Beale Air Force Base. And I walked with one of them one day to the school, and I thought these were the prettiest little children. They were beautiful to me, some of them with their little almond eyes and, you know, and the little Mexican children. They were all sparkling clean and dressed up to go to school, little first graders or kindergarten children. And I thought, how beautiful they are. Well, here were these other Memphis mothers, because this whole group was Memphis people, the group headquarters, you know. They were fearful of their little child sitting in the school with these different nationalities.
When was this?
It was 1951. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it's probably 1950. Yeah, it was 1950. Because we came home in first part of 1952. We were out there, I don't know, I've forgotten that, 17 months. But, you know, so I know full well how they think and how they feel about that mixing. Mm-hmm. As if it's going to wear off. Well, some of them here still say, one lady used to live down the street here from us, and she moved because her child was in the public school, and she had left her as a young child, and the child was beginning to talk, she says, like the blacks talked.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I didn't hear the child myself, so I don't know, but she said she's picking up their language. So they took her out and they moved out to the county, county schools. So that's the whole thing, you know. It's just, to me it's sad. I know there's a difference in people and there's a difference in the level of education and refinement, if you want to call it refinement. But, you know, my mother would always say to me, it doesn't matter what other people do. You don't have to do what other people, just because they do it, you don't have to do it. You know, we don't do that in our family. And she used to always say, everybody else runs, jump off the bridge. You don't have to go jump off the bridge. So, you know, I don't see why other people can't have that same attitude too. You go along and do what you have to do, but you don't have to pick up all the worst of what other people do.
You mentioned that you were, or the League of Women's Voters was involved with the Freedom Train. So were you involved with the League of Women Voters before 1958?
No, I wasn't with them when the Freedom Train came.
Okay. I knew that was like in 1947.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
What was women's activism like in political campaigns when you were with the League of Women Voters?
The League is nonpartisan, and we do not if you're a board member, that is. I have to clarify that. Board members cannot be involved in partisan politics.
Okay.
Now, just the members, if they don't hold a board position, they can go and support candidates.
Okay.
So, but the league itself and those who represent the league to the public, they have to focus on the issues and not the candidates. So I got my early political education in the league, and I started out then focusing on the issues.
Yeah.
And it was so great for me because I learned to be objective about the issues, which, you know, most people don't learn because they start out going with a friend to a political organization, and then they don't ever... They take one side, you know, they take a side.
Yeah.
They don't ever analyze the issues impartially.
Mm-hmm.
But League of Women Voters do.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I had been, you know, from my early family problems, I'd learned to analyze issues too.
Huh.
You know, just seeing, because... I could see the difference in the family when one group was talking about the other group, you know. And it would cause me to wonder what's going on. And
sure.
And
how big was the League of Women Voters? How many members did you have?
Very small.
Yeah.
No, I can't tell you the number. 50 to... Maybe it averaged around 50.
Okay.
Sometimes a little more, a little less.
Yeah.
But the main reason was most of the league members were from out of town.
Huh.
Very.